This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We are still on remote. Pat Baldata is a poet and a novelist. She's here. She has the most fabulous book about women pilots. She herself was a pilot, and she's going to open with a poem. Here's Pat.
Hi, Grace. Thank you for having me. This is the first poem in my book. The title of the book is Where No Man Can Touch, and it's called Joie, which is the French word for joy. I floated over Lyon all alone. It was just as you had promised, Cher. My heart was filled with joie du ballon. I could see the whole city of Lyon with perfect clarity in the morning air while I floated over Lyon all alone. I had to shield my eyes against the sun that shone above the steeples in the square, my soul transported by joie du ballon. I soared so near to heaven's throne, the awe was almost more than I could bear as I floated over Lyon all alone. This vista should be seen by everyone. I wished more of mes soeurs would dare the thrilling flight of joie du ballon. I knew that soon this flight would be done and nothing in the future would compare. My rapture was toute joie du ballon when I floated over Lyon all alone. And that was Jeanne Labrosse, the very first woman to fly by herself in any aircraft. It was a hot air balloon, and believe it or not, it was in 1798.
At Baldata. Was that a pantoum or a gazelle?
That was a villanelle, actually.
Every one of these pages has a different form, and the first section of the book are poets from the 1700s and 1800s. Pat Baldata, there is nothing like this book that exists. Do you agree?
No, I don't think there is, which is why I wrote it. No.
Okay, tell us, just describe what's in this book. Tell us the sections of the times, the eras.
Sure. I go from the, as I said, the 18th century and then the 19th century, and most of it is in the 20th century, but it goes from about 1900 until 1953, when Jackie Cochran was the first woman to break the sound barrier. Oh, and I wanted to focus on these women that no one has heard of anymore. They've been lost to history. They used to make front page news in the New York Times. And now if you ask people about a pioneering woman pilot, they'll always say Amelia Earhart. But there were actually dozens and dozens of women who were amazing. And I fly, so I feel like I'm flying on their shoulders. And so I wanted people to know more about them.
But then the degree of difficulty of changing each voice into a different poetic form is, again, such a precious thing. There must be more women pilots, of course, that you didn't cover. It seems to me that you covered the first one to do this, the first Black pilot, the first Asian American pilot, the first one to go cross Atlantic. So did you do that? Did you try to find a pilot at the zenith of flying? What was your selection choice?
I mostly wanted to find women who were the first at doing something. It's not necessarily their biggest accomplishment, but I wanted to really focus on women for whom this would be the first time a woman has done this, because most people don't even think of women as being pioneers and being first in anything regarding aviation. So I wanted to let people know that once upon a time, they really were doing firsts, like Sally Ride did, you know, and space and Valeria Tereshkova, I'm messing up her name, but the Russian woman pilot who was the very first woman in space. So people forget that women have done firsts.
Well, you know, this should be in every classroom. And I can only imagine what it took, because you read memoirs, you read letters, you went to primary sources. Tell us about the very first time you got the idea and what was the first thing you did. Was it to go to the library? Was it to make a list? What was the first thing you did?
The very first thing, believe it or not, I was sitting in a poetry conference lecture that I was not entirely interested in. And I started thinking about writing in form because I hadn't done that much of it, and I thought it would be a lot of fun. And I tried to think of who's I love writing persona poems because I write fiction as well. I love telling stories and writing as the character. So I was trying to think of who would I most want to meet or get to know. And it was Bessie Coleman, who was the first African-American pilot worldwide and the first one in the United States. And she's just such an inspiration to me and I think to every other person. And I was sitting there starting to write about her. I already knew something about her life. And I felt like I was channeling her or she was channeling me. And I just, the first draft came out fairly quickly. And then, of course, you polish and polish and polish. But she was really the first. So.
And how many years in the making?
What?
The whole book.
Oh, the whole book. I went to the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts for two consecutive residencies, and I wrote most of the drafts while I was there. I challenged myself to write a poem in the morning and a poem in the afternoon and come up with first drafts. So
where did you get the research, though?
I had done the research before then, so I came armed with a huge binder full of printouts from websites and a number of books that I had, and, you know, anything I could find about them, and went down there with just this giant pile of books and papers and
I have to tell them who you are, and then we're going to hear a couple of these poems.
Okay.
This book, Where No Man Can Touch, which is actually a line from one of the women poets, won the 2015 Donald Justice Poetry Prize. That is a national award. Then Pat's third novel, Eve's Daughters, won first prize from the Delaware Press Association and another prize from the National Federation of Press Women. And her poetry has appeared many places all over America. It would take us a long time to read them. She's won Individual Artist Award from Maryland State Arts Council. She's in Crisfield, Maryland. She was an aviator. And by gosh, she has given the world something to remember. Is this going to be in libraries?
It's probably in a few. I have to say the worst thing is the book is currently out of print, but I'm working with a publisher to get a revised edition out, and hopefully that will happen this year.
There has to be a major marketing effort to go to the American Library Association to get this in every library. So okay. Let's hear a couple of poems.
Sure.
Pat Valdatta.
This next one is called La Prima Donna. And it's about Thérèse Pelletier, who was the first woman to solo an airplane. She did that in September 1908, which was only 5 years after the Wright brothers' first flight. La Prima Donna. I flew 200 meters in Turin, not high, not fast, but first. I flew an airplane, no Zeppelin. I flew 200 meters in Turin. I'm being called a heroine in papers sold by Mr. Hearst. I flew 200 meters in Turin, not high, not fast, but first. So she was the first in the world, Thérèse Pelletier, in 1908.
What a great last line.
So in the United States, there's a little controversy over who was first. One woman, Blanche Scott, wasn't supposed to take off, but perhaps she did accidentally on purpose. But the woman who gets the credit for the flight was named Bessica Raish. So I'm going to read her first officially. This was September 1910. Makes no never mind to me whether Blanche was first or I. Point was, we women were in the air, finally. Shoot, I drove a Willys by myself across the country. I was a new woman, wore bloomers proudly, capable as any man. Flying couldn't be too hard. Newspapers called me first woman aviator. Sure, it was grand, but there isn't much meaning in just going up to buzz around. They were needing doctors out west, so I traded the stick for med school. Now I fly a stethoscope. But sometimes, after nightfall, I'll dream about it. Feel the controls in my hands again. Hear the wires whistling in the wind.
Pat, do you think there's a common thread psychologically with all these women? You've studied their backgrounds and their histories and their voices. Are they exceptional? Is there one common thread, like they were tomboys or loved machinery? I know a couple of them have talked about driving a car when they were 12 or a tractor.
Right.
So give us a profile of all these women, or can you say that there is not one common denominator?
Well, the only real common denominator is that we all love flying, and that just is something, it just gets into you. You love being in the air, you love being up there and seeing the world from that altitude. So I think that's really the only true common denominator. The very early ones probably were a little less girly than some, but I'll tell you, all the women in the 30s and 40s and 50s, they flew in skirts, they wore makeup, they made sure they combed their hair before they got out of the cockpit. So there was a whole range of femininity there. So it's just that everybody loves the air, and that's the main thing.
There is one component, however, that I saw, and it is courage.
Right, because it was very dangerous to fly back in those days, yeah.
Pat, it still takes courage to get up in the air. I mean, I think that's one thing that you're underestimating, because it was easy for you.
Oh, no, not at all. No, I'm not a natural pilot. It was a lot of hard work, a lot of study, a lot of training. So, no, it wasn't easy. But when you go up and you repeat it and you do it over and over, it's kind of like being in a writing program. You know, you write a poem and then you get comments and you revise and you revise and you revise. And all training is very similar, isn't it?
However, you were never afraid.
Of course, I was.
You weren't afraid to do it, though, to try to do it, to learn to do it.
Sure I was. Everybody's afraid at some point. Absolutely. Yeah, you can't fly totally fearlessly, even though some of my pilots may claim to do that in this book. But no, everybody has moments where you sit there and go, oh, I hope I'm going to be okay. I hope I come out of this okay.
Well, I have idealized you.
I think you have.
And I just think it is a wonderful thing. Of course, my husband was a naval aviator, and flying is just, to me, a magical event. How many women do you think are flying today?
It's somewhere around only about 6 or 7% of all the licensed pilots in the country are women.
And how many?
And that
commercial
number has not changed in decades. It's still a very small number.
And would you say commercial airlines, that it's even less?
Probably, but there are a lot of young women who were training to become commercial pilots now. So I think that number is going to go up quite a bit in the next few years.
Wow. Let us hear two more poems and set them up and do us the favor of telling us the form you're using.
Okay.
I think I heard a sonnet first, and then there was a villanelle.
There was the villanelle, and then a triolet. Or triolet, I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
And what is that?
That's the little repetitive form that I did for the prima donna. And it's a little French form. And again, because she was French, I wanted to use a French form for her. And others are nonce forms. I mean, sometimes they, you know, there's, you know, four lines, two of the lines rhyme, two don't, you know, a fairly normal kind of form. This next one I'm going to read is about a woman who gave up flying. And I wanted to include her because so many women did have to make that choice back in the 1910s. Are you going to do what your heart tells you to do, or are you going to conform to society? And this one it's just eight lines, and the first lines rhyme, the second, the third, and the fourth. So it's not a form. I don't think it's an actual form. It's just what happened. And sometimes that's how it works out. So this is in honor of Mary Highsmith Sims Heinrich, who was married in December 1914. It's called Regrets. He taught me to fly, and when my instructor proposed, he said he loved me, so he asked if I would give up flying. It seemed a simple choice then, and I was so disposed, but there are days when I look at the sky and I start crying.
I love that one. That is meaningful even today. Some women are giving up great sports championships to have a family. Let's have another.
And this is the first one that I wrote about Bessie Coleman, who got her license on the 15th of June, 1921. It's called Plans. And she was from Waxahachie, Texas. White men in Waxahachie, plain won't teach me, nor any men north or south. Being female and black, they say, I can't learn such things. But my full-lipped mouth loves aileron, chandelle, empennage. So while I file the flapper's smoke-stained nails, I practice aerodrome and fuselage and save my tips. One day, I'll do a tail slide overseas and split S slow roll where la vie est belle, instructors colorblind. Then, when I've joined those masters of the air, I'll glide beneath the cloud base unconfined, make my way back home, barnstorm the sky, and watch the white folk pay to see me fly.
She was your hero.
She's my hero for sure. I have a t-shirt with her picture on it, and she's just absolutely my hero.
Well, it is not to be a curmudgeon, but in the beginning, there was a lot of hostility from the men. I mean, open hostility. Even our mutual friend, Ann Dar, the poet, was a WASP. in World War II, and she said men put sugar in their someone's gas tank.
Yes.
Sugar in the gas tank,
yes.
So it wouldn't fly. But we will talk about those people later on.
Okay.
I just want to know how you decided, here's the voice of the poet, here's her personality, here's what she really did. What form would be right for her? How did that come out?
That was just by just trying to inhabit her spirit. If it sounds kind of touchy-feely to do that, but I wanted to write her story and try to use what I think might be her voice, because of course I can't know. And it just, whatever worked for that poet, you know?
It must be intuitive, yeah.
It was more intuitive than anything, yeah. I tend not to plan these things out very much, but yeah, it was just intuitive.
Well, when I read the book, that's one thing which I've marveled at, how you caught the essence of the particular woman in a form that fit that woman. And so let's go on further and experience it.
Okay. And again, it's my idea of the woman. So as a fiction writer, I think of these as small fictions as well, even though they're grounded in as much research as I can. Someone else that people just probably never heard of, if I said Phoebe Fairgrave Omley to you, you probably have not heard of this woman.
Say the name again.
Phoebe Fairgrave Omley. She was born in 1902. She died in 1975. And her story is very sad. She started out, she owned a flying circus in 1921. She was the first woman to get a transport pilot's license in 1927. She was the first woman to cross the Rocky Mountains in a small airplane. She did that in 1929. She won the very first women's transcontinental air derby in the light planes. That was in 1929. People have called it the Powder Puff Derby, but she was the first one to do it in the light aircraft. And she was the first woman to hold the federal government position in aviation in 1934. So she's very accomplished. In her day was very well known, but she ended up in obscurity. And so I wrote about that phase of her life. Grounded. Those good old boys at the far end of the bar think I'm just another bourbon-swillen broad. But I could tell them stories. I danced the Charleston on the top wing of a biplane. Back in 22, I set a world record jumping from a plane 3 miles high. Only stunt I wouldn't do twice, I'll tell you. When that new chute didn't open at first, I thought, sure, I'd auger in. But when you're 20 years old, you can't stay on the ground for long. I even hung from a rope by my teeth while Vern flew low and fast over the crowds. And who do you think did stunts for the Perils of Pauline? My, that was a fun job. Then I got my hands on a fast little monocoupe and off I went, touring 6,000 miles in 32 cities, just me and Miss Memphis. Had my mechanic's license by then and did all my own repairs. Didn't want anyone saying a man did any of my flying for me. My, she was a sweet little flying machine, all of 65 horses, but she could go fast. Made it from Santa Monica to Cleveland in just 25 hours and 10 minutes. Oh, those were the days. One race, I beat 55 other pilots, 36 of them men. Finished in the top money time and time again. Even got Mrs. Roosevelt's attention. I suppose a lot of the fun went out after Vern died. I worked hard for aviation, but after the war years, I just couldn't bring myself to settle down. Got to be good friends with Mr. Beam and Mr. Daniels here. Lungs aren't worth a damn anymore, and I think I'll be checking out sooner rather than later. So pour me another, hun, and just leave the bottle.
Is there a reason for that poem? Did you know that she really drank?
Oh, yes, she did. She ended up, sadly, she died impoverished and an alcoholic, and it was a very, very sad story.
Do you know the story of every one of these women you've written about, or did some you have to imagine?
Oh, I had to research all of them. Yeah, I didn't know many of them at all. I just started looking up first women to do things, and it was just amazing to find out so much.
I can't begin to tell you what I think, that this is a true groundbreaking book. I didn't know any. I knew about five of the women,
yeah.
And I'm ashamed to say, but and as I read this book, it is one that you will reread because the poems are brief and they're very powerful, but you get caught. And the interesting thing is because you varied the forms,
right.
The book is has an energy.
Thank
it has
you.
A compression and an expansion. It's not like just one block of text after another. There's actually the spirit of the woman jumps out of the page at you. And I think that that is because you went to, you captured the art in a form which has their breath. So let's continue with two more. I really want everyone to know as much as possible.
Thank you. A lot of people don't realize that the first woman to fly commercially for an airline did that way back in 1928. And I think most people don't realize that. Not in this country, of course. It was decades after that before American women could do that. But Marga von Etzdorf was a German pilot, and she flew for Lufthansa in 1928. And then in 1931, she was the first woman to fly over Siberia and go from Europe to Japan. So she flew an airplane that was a very odd one. The pilot and co-pilot sat in an open cockpit and the passengers were enclosed behind them. So the passengers sat in comfort and the pilot and co-pilot froze. And it was called a Junkers F-13. So that's the airplane that I mentioned. This is called co-pilot. This open cockpit Junkers F-13 may be no beauty, but she's what I fly. Four passengers inside while Herr Pilot and I hunker down beneath a tiny windscreen. With each kilometer that passes by, I'm doing what no other woman can. The cargo wants to think that I'm a man. I'm glad to play along. Who cares? The sky is all. Berlin to Stuttgart or Japan, with a well-oiled motor, a compass and map, goggles, helmet, and a sable-lined cap, I can fly any air route over sea or land. With luck and good weather, I'll soon be home. Come see my perfect landing at Berlin Aerodrome.
Did the passengers know a woman was flying?
No, they hid it from them because they knew they would be upset. So she put the helmet on first, and wearing the heavy jacket, you couldn't tell. So they hid that.
So good. So good.
Let me read the poem that I get my book title from. Most people know Anne Mara Lindbergh, who was Charles's wife, but she was a pilot in her own right. And she was the first woman to get a first-class glider license. And that required her to stay up for 5 minutes at least. If you stayed up for 1 minute, you get a third-class glider license. So she was the first woman to do that. But this was her first and only glider flight, which I think is very sad. But she had, as we all know, a very, very sad life after all the pioneering flying that they did. So she wrote poetry, and my refrain to this poem and where the book title comes from is taken from one of her poems, Even, and it's in her book, The Unicorn and Other Poems. So it's, her plane was called the Albatross, and that's the title of the poem, Albatross. Above the pines, supported by the air like the gulls over the sea whirling, with them I share 6 minutes of solitude, each where no man can touch, no shout can reach. Savoring the sense of altitude to spare, I turn north from Mount Soledad, hearing nothing but the seagull's raucous screech, where no man can touch, no shout can reach. Like them, I bank upon a pair of long, thin wings, while gliding in this albatross just a mile from the beach, where no man can touch, no shout can reach. Later, when sitting in the courtroom's glare or hounded by the ever-present press, I'll close my eyes to block discordant speech, and for perhaps 6 minutes, we'll again be here, where no man can touch, no shout can reach.
How honest.
Thank you.
How honest. I'm so glad you included that. Do you want to just briefly tell the audience who may not remember what her dilemma was?
Well, her dilemma was she was married to an incredibly famous man who was the first person to cross the Atlantic solo. But then after that, they had settled down in a small town in New Jersey and were starting their family, and their little toddler boy was kidnapped and murdered. And so that overshadowed the rest of their lives, which was very, very sad.
And yet did she fly after that at all?
They did do a little bit of flying after that. Yeah, mm-hmm. She did, because they continued exploring. They opened up air routes over to Asia and in various places around the world. So they did do quite a bit of flying together. And she would often do the radio work and some of the navigation for Charles.
You know, the body of knowledge that you have behind each one of these that is not on the page is yet to be compiled, I think. Now, you're writing a book of fiction, about right. women pilots. Mm-hmm. And how did you even, after this, after all that research, how did right. you garner the energy to start the long marathon, which a novel is a long marathon?
It is, but I love it. And I love doing research. I really, really do. So for me, the research is the easiest part by far. I can procrastinate on my writing very well by spending the whole day doing research. But a few years ago, I was in near Baltimore at the Martin State Aircraft Museum, and that used to be an aircraft factory in World War II. That's where Glenn Martin's big aviation company was. And I met some of the women who were the Rosie the Riveters who helped put these airplanes together. And also at other events, I met some of the women's Air Force Service pilots, the WASPs like Ann Dar, who flew the planes and ferried them all over the United States. So I thought it would be really fun to write about those women. Again, people are forgetting who they are. They're forgetting what their accomplishments are. And they're getting older and older every year. There are very few of them left. In fact, one of them just passed away a few weeks ago. She was 104 years old.
What does WASP mean?
Women's Air Force Service Pilots. So everybody calls them the WASPs. And so I wanted to write about that. So I've been researching and writing that, and that's really a joy, and it's been a whole lot of fun to do.
Are you going to focus on the particular women, or are you going to talk about it as a phenomenon, or are you going to identify them as you did in this book?
No, this is going to be different. Because it's a novel, I'm trying to tell the stories of each of these women. So the book's going to be divided into three sections, and I'm going to follow one of the Rosies for the first part, one of the WASPs for the second part, and then finish up with the airplane that one of them built and one of them flew, flying in World War II.
And the fact that you know aircraft is a great bonus. You literally have to, you go in just feeling confident because you can describe all these parts of the airplane very well. So yeah. I don't think you could have written any of this if you were not a pilot, do you?
I think it would have been a whole lot harder and a lot harder to imagine what it's like to be in the air and to be experiencing the things the women were doing. Yeah, I wish every woman would get in the air at least once. I mean, I just think it is so much fun to fly, and it's so amazing to hold the controls in your hands and be the owner of your own destiny. It's a phenomenal thing. So I wish more women would do it. There's nothing like it.
Oh, Pat, I'm just going to make sure. I wish every woman would read this book, just for starters.
Thank you.
I know that you have written several books, and so I would like to just have the audience hear something from another, a former work. So if
sure.
you'll just tell us what that is and what you're going to read, that will be our final poem.
Okay, my first full-length book was Inherent Vice. I have a chapbook called Looking for Bivalve, but Inherent Vice was my first one, published by Pecan Grove Press, by Palmer Hall, who's a wonderful, wonderful poet and publisher and teacher, and sadly he passed away a few years ago. But this book, it's some of the poems are informed, some are not, so this is more of a little a mix, and I don't know, this is one of the love poems. I've been married a long time, so I like to write about my husband sometimes and things that he does. This is called Her General Theory of Relativity. He's watching Star Trek again, that episode where Einstein, Newton, and Hawking play poker with data. He's eating a tomato, lets its sweet flesh compress between his teeth, squirt juice down his stubble. But zoom in a couple orders of magnitude, there is no tomato, no he, just space and atoms. You have to dive deep into the nucleus to find any charm at all. It's all related, generally speaking, space and tomatoes and 25 years, only the weak force of gravity keeping them together. If time travel were possible, would she take it all back to the evening he proposed? There was no tomato then, no data. On days she thinks time runs fixotropic like ketchup in the bottle she needs to shake up, she knows it's more. The way shifting a single electron from an atom of friable metal to an atom of poisonous gas creates the sodium chloride without which they would die. Like salt, they can't exist alone. To split them up would take more energy than the universe can spare.
Patricia, Pat Valdatta, you're my cultural hero. And that is the voice of Patricia Valdatta.
Thank
and
you.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, still remote. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our production team is Elizabeth Comets, podcast, Peter Von Fall, website, and Henry Crawford, YouTube. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.